Welcome to the Sunflower Conversations, where we explore the hidden disability sunflower and its role in supporting people with hidden disabilities.
Our guest is Lisa Nice, who has multiple sclerosis. Lisa works for the charity Comic Relief and is also part of their internal WECAN group. WECAN stands for Wellness, Enablement, Carers, Disability and Neurodiversity. So Paul and I are very much looking forward to getting into that chat in a little moment. But welcome, Lisa. Paul, let me just have a little chat with you to start off with. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, Chantel. It's been a while since I've done this.
It has been.
Yeah, and so I'm a little bit rusty, but I'm also excited, and it's nice to be back with you doing a podcast and a chat and meeting Lisa and having a conversation. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I mean, the Sunflower Conversations now have been in existence for a couple of years, haven't they? Started off as a video interview format, and now we've progressed into podcasting. So from you started it, so how do you see that it's evolved since then?
It has changed greatly, and I think it was something that obviously when it started off was something that was in its literally in at its beginnings. And so it sort of started off to begin with more of a kind of just a regular chat. It was also video based, and it wasn't a podcast, so it was typically shorter. And I don't know whether we had quite as much purpose or as kind of it wasn't quite as directional. Now things have changed. You're doing it now, all the time, and I'm not doing it so much. And I think it has become more focused. We also do a bit of both. So we use that and repurpose it for both video and for audio. So that's something that we can use for either. But what it allows us to do by doing podcasts is to drill down and really sort of learn about conditions, and then share those learnings with others. So that's, I think, what's really changed. I think obviously also we've learned along the way about what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
For example, talking to somebody prior to actually having the meeting, I think with hindsight, is something that is very, very useful. Just little things, making sure that people are comfortable. And, you know, still I get nervous, and I am clearly, you know, now, but it's about kind of making people feel relaxed and then speaking to us about their conditions and obviously expressing and telling us what they are prepared to tell us, so that we can then share that information on our platforms to others who are similar. So yeah, I think it's changed and it's got a lot better.
But I guess in the beginning as well, it was informing people about what the sunflower was as well, in a sense, wasn't it? You know, at its infancy, whereas now, particularly in the UK, so many more people are aware of the hidden disability sunflower. We've still got a long way to go, but yeah. As you said, it allows us now the space to actually find out more about people's health conditions and really use this as a tool for learning and an expansion and helping people on their disability inclusive journey. If they've got a loved one that's been diagnosed with something and their mind is blown, it's a little insight into somebody's life who has that condition. And I think that hearing things from people with lived experience is just so important.
I think you're 100% right, and I think now it has direction. And I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to use that content that we get from people who we speak to that are kind enough to talk to us about their conditions, and we then share that with society, with people, and that can be business based as well as somebody in a family, for example, who needs to learn. And that's really important, so that hopefully we are spreading awareness and helping with those messages and understandings,
Yeah, and I'm excited to be co hosting again. That's nice. I enjoyed doing it on my own because I like to chat, but it is nice to co-host so that our listeners get to know a bit more of, just hear a little bit more from the team. And also when you've got two of you doing it, you might pick up on something that the other person hasn't. So it allows kind of wider conversation. So you're back, and we can expect to have you on here a little bit more often.
No, thanks for inviting me again, and I'm looking forward to it.
So let's waste no more time, and let's welcome Lisa. It was ages ago that you and I had a chat about you appearing on the podcast. So thank you very much for like giving up your time, and I'm really pleased that we've been able to make that happen. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Really happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me along.
So can you explain what We Can means? That's your group, your well-being group at Comic Relief. What does it stand for?
So it stands for Wellness Enablement, Carers, Disability and Neurodiversity. So we cover quite a broad range of areas, and we wanted to come up with a name that was easy to remember and really positive, because we think whatever we're navigating, we can achieve it with the right support in place. And it's just a really lovely group. It's full of amazing people. We all learn from one another. Part of our purpose is that we provide peer support to one another and create a safe space for each other. Everyone in the group has either direct or indirect lived experience of the areas we cover. And part of what we do also is to kind of build awareness and understanding across the organization of these areas, and support the wider diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging work at Comic Relief. So, for example, we might make recommendations, we might input into processes, we might review policies, etc.
I love that. That's great. Two things I pick up on that is disability. It's written with a capital A, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So, we didn't want to remove the word disability because, quite rightly, people can be very proud to have a disability. But we also wanted to kind of focus on the word ability. So that's why we kind of changed that word.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good. And I also like the other thing that you say about it's a peer-to-peer support group as well, so that people can have that chat with somebody who will give that understanding ear, which is so important, because you can be going through so much with your health at home, and we spend so much time at work or working. To be able to have that opportunity to have a kind of safe space, which you met, how you phrased it, really important.
Yeah, and it's kind of also having a common understanding of some challenges that you may face, because I think when we're just advocating for ourselves, we kind of tend to let things go a little more. But if we know someone else is experiencing it too, then we're more likely to take action. So I think it's those kind of things really come out when you're having these conversations as a group and really listening to one another.
That's so true. You do let things go for yourself, don't you? But if you hear somebody else is having a challenge, your warrior kind of appears, and you think, why can't I do that for myself?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, and then I think if you become more aware of that, then actually you do start advocating more for yourself. But yeah, it isn't, I don't think it's a natural thing that happens for most people. I mean, maybe some, but
Well, that's it's it sounds brilliant, and all credit to Comic Relief for getting that together. You are listening to the Sunflower Conversations with Paul and Chantal. To learn more about the Sunflower, visit our website. Details are in the show notes. So you have multiple sclerosis. It is genetic, or is it genetic, and how does it affect you?
So no, it's not genetic that we know, but there are lots of unknowns. With multiple sclerosis, which I'll probably just say MS from now on, it's an autoimmune condition. So it impacts your brain and your spinal cord. And with the condition, your immune system mistakenly attacks myelin, and that's the protective coating around your nerves that enables those brain signals and messages to travel quickly along the nerve cells. So when this happens to the nerves, it leaves lesions and disrupts the signals. So that causes various different symptoms depending on exactly where the lesions are in your brain and your spine.
There's a few of them, isn't there? Actually, I was looking earlier, fatigue, optic neurosis, loss of vision, you know, weakness of limbs, reduced coordination, balance problems, it goes on. So, yeah, I'd imagine that's very challenging.
Yeah, I mean, it's very unique to the individual because it varies based on where their lesions are. Yeah. And yeah, like it's, the list is like really lengthy, yeah, because it can cause so many different symptoms. And yeah, they don't really fully understand why people get MS yet. There's still loads of unknowns. They don't think that it's directly inherited from parent to child. However, family members may have a higher risk of getting MS. No one in my family has had it, to my knowledge.
Does anybody in your family have any other autoimmune disorders you know of? Because there's hundreds of autoimmune.
Yeah, not in my immediate family that kind of springs to mind. Maybe if you go a bit further, but yeah, there's nothing obvious.
Yeah.
Nothing obvious. But yeah, there's so many risk factors that apparently might increase your chance of getting MS. But again, it's all a little like, they can show, the stats show that it might increase your chance, but we don't know if it actually causes it. So I had a vitamin D deficiency. So that could have potentially been one of my triggers, but we don't really know that for sure either, because there are other triggers, and it's all a bit unknown at the moment.
Lisa, did you, what interests me as well, I'm sure Shanta will go on to asking you about this, is, but it's obviously these symptoms, I mean, I'm sure that would have been very challenging working out eventually and being diagnosed. But it's like, well, when did it begin? And was it like when you were very young? Did you have symptoms of dizziness, for example, that were mild and then it became more acute? Or was it all together? Because that's something that, and how on earth do you then think, well, this is bad enough for me to actually go and seek advice or seek, you know, getting it diagnosed?
Yeah, well, I would say there were definitely telltale signs that I would have no idea what they were, but like with hindsight, which is a wonderful thing. But when it actually became like a bit more kind of, oh, there's definitely a problem now that I need to deal with, was I'd been in London all day. I came back. It was over Christmas and I was staying at my parents'. And I came back kind of mid-afternoon and I had really painful muscle ache. I had to lie down because I just felt it all over, and I just suddenly felt so tired and I just fell straight asleep. It was only afternoon and I think I didn't wake up till the next day, and something just didn't feel right. It sort of continued on, so I went to the doctor, and then diagnosis sort of started there. I had my blood tests. We realized my vitamin D was low at that point, so we thought, oh, that's it, we're gonna fix it. But sadly that did not fix it. It did actually get rid of the muscle pain at that time, but then slowly other symptoms started developing.
So yeah, what are those symptoms, like how are you affected by your MS?
Yeah, well, it sort of depends. So at that point, because I have what is known as relapsing remitting MS. So there are three different types of MS. There's primary progressive, secondary progressive, and there's relapsing remitting. And I have the latter. And that means that I have a relapse where my symptoms come on really strong and then they go into remission a little. Some things hang around, stick around for either forever or for a while afterwards. But obviously when you're going through diagnosis, you don't know any of this. So when I had my first relapses, I didn't know what it was. And I had loads of symptoms that came on gradually. I started to struggle walking. I would trip over and fall flat on my face. I developed a foot drop. So I was constantly worried about tripping over. My walking.
Can you explain that? So, what's a foot drop?
A foot drop. So that's where, like, your foot sort of drags on the floor, I think is how I would describe it.
Is it, so you like don't realize,
but it's not like pressing properly on the floor.
Wow.
So yeah, you're just more likely to trip up. It makes it difficult walking.
Yeah.
And yeah, what else happened? So my walking slowed right down, like, as well. I think because the brain signals weren't communicating properly, I just couldn't get my legs to move fast. It was very frustrating.
Lisa, was it scary? Was it, what did it really alarm you when that first had those symptoms first appeared, or did they just become progressively worse? You know, is it something that just suddenly happened and you're like, what is happening?
Yeah, no, it was so slow. And for me, in my experience, I, first of all, I put it down to vitamin D. So I was like, that's okay, we found a solution. And that was just not just muscle pain. It was quite horrific. But at that point, I was like, that's fine, this is going to end. And then after that, I got in my head, which I think has happened to other people too, that it was a trapped nerve.
Okay.
So I was thinking, that's fine too, it will be resolved.
Fixable.
It didn't really explain everything, but I think you kind of cling on to some kind of explanation that works for you at the time. And to be honest, even though I know people with MS, it didn't even occur to me that that was what it could be. I think I got more scared when it progressed to my hand and I lost the fine motor skills in my right hand. So we think I must have had another relapse. And I couldn't grip. So I'd be holding something. I think I was still holding it, but it was smashed on the floor.
Oh my God.
And I couldn't handwrite anymore. And that for me was, I don't know why, but for some reason, out of everything, that was the thing that really upset me the most and I felt most emotional about.
So it sounds like it would come and go. So you could hold something 1 minute and then all of a sudden it's gone.
No, not at that point. That was pretty constant, to be absolutely honest. Maybe I could hold it for a couple of minutes or seconds, not even minutes, seconds. Yeah. But yeah, to be honest, at that point, I just got to the point where people had to cut my food for me. I couldn't open like jars, all those kind of real practical difficulties, like doing up the buttons on my clothing was really difficult. Because my coordination also wasn't really there.
Yeah.
Those kind of symptoms were really, really tough. And I feel quite lucky that once I did get diagnosed, it did turn out to be relapsing remitting. Because for some people, like, once they get those symptoms, that's it. So that's really, really hard. And it's not doing away from my experience, because it's also hard when it's relapsing and remitting, but I feel lucky to have that remission period.
Yeah, you do get a bit of a reprieve from it. But again, that just speaks to your approach, you know, your mental health approach, because some people with relapse and remitting wouldn't feel fortunate, sort of thing. So that says a lot about you. And the muscle pain interests me as well. Does it feel like, you know, when you have flu and it, like, you can't move your limbs, is it similar to that, or can you describe it?
Yeah, it has been, but I also had, I think it's got a medical name, but I don't actually know what it is, sorry. I actually had it where I couldn't even rest my own finger on my leg without the muscle feeling in agony. Like it literally felt like I had like whacked myself. I think it's actually got a name, but I'm not sure what that is. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
It's just that kind of like level of sensitivity. It just felt so painful. And obviously this is all invisible symptoms. And another one, that one of the more random symptoms is called the MS hug. And that was just such a bizarre symptom when I was experiencing it, because I felt like I was wearing an elasticated skirt inside my body that was like too tight, way too tight. And all the time it was hard to breathe.
Oof.
Which sounded, even to me, like I was like, what is happening? This is so weird. But actually, when I got diagnosed and looked into different symptoms, it's actually a symptom called the MS hug. And again, that probably feels slightly different for different people, but I definitely recognized what I was reading as what I had experienced. And then random symptoms like my toes felt like they were stuck together.
Oh gosh.
I had like a couple of weeks where I just smelled unclean. And that I really found hard too. So
yeah. And I'm sure everybody around you was saying you don't smell at all.
Yeah. Like it would literally be like I could have stepped out the shower and to me I smelled unclean. So I kind of knew it wasn't true, but it still smelled that way to me.
So I think that's an anosmia, I think that's called, isn't it? When it's, the smell is gone, or it's tainted, it switches.
Okay.
My goodness, that's a lot. So did you have to make like changes to your life?
Yeah, so I've had to slow down. I don't have all of those symptoms on an ongoing basis. I think my daily symptoms now are more around fatigue, brain fog, I do still sometimes get muscle pain. Those kind of symptoms more now. So I have to plan my time in a way that I wouldn't have before. I've always been really social. I always had lots in the calendar, but I've had to really cut back. And I always refer to the spoons analogy. Do you know that one?
I do know it, but please say it again, because I think that our listeners who haven't heard it will be keen to find out what it means.
Yeah, so the analogy is that you have a certain number of spoons each week and they kind of represent your energy. So each week you have to ration them across the week. So you have to be careful not to use too many spoons on one day. So for me, I don't want to use up all my spoons, because then the remaining days of the week are going to be much, much tougher. I do have to plan a lot more. And another change I find is that I have to use public transport or taxis more, because if I walk too much or exert myself, then my body gets really physically tired, and then I can feel some symptoms coming back or getting worse. And although I do need to plan, I also have to be more open to adjusting plans, both inside and outside the home. So if my concentration span is being unkind, then I can't sit and watch a film. If I'm feeling fatigued, I can't go and make a journey. So I guess everything's dictated a lot more by my body.
And it sounds to me like you really listen to your body.
I've had to, I think.
Yeah.
I think I didn't for a long time, but yeah, now I don't really have a choice. You just come to realize, I think, that you're doing, if you don't listen to your body, then you're going to do yourself a disservice. You're going to have to make up for it. So it's really about thinking about the bigger picture all the time, like, managing that.
I think also, you don't know what you're going to get almost from week to week, right? So you literally, it has to ebb and flow. So it's not like there's a consistency here. We're talking about one week you could feel actually quite good, and then other weeks you could feel terrible. So it's about how you react. And do you have learnings from that? Is that something you've become better at with time?
Yeah, I've I think so. I think I'm beginning to. Maybe it's still like an ongoing thing.
You know, for example, if you're having a bad week, do you know how to kind of deal with that slightly better than perhaps you did 2 or 3 years ago, for example, or when you first diagnosed? I'm just trying to gauge how you, your coping mechanisms, how you deal with things. And have you got any sort of tips for people listening on what to do, how to treat something if something's coming and you're feeling it? Is it something you preempt? Do you see it? Do you feel it coming? Like, I get migraines and I know when they're coming. And so I can feel it coming on. And so I kind of go somewhere and I know how to kind of deal with that with experience. I'm just curious to know how you deal with that.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's acceptance for me. It's kind of, I mean, fatigue can just come on so suddenly, and that's probably the biggest issue. And you can try and manage it with, you know, with exercise, with diet. Like, there are various things that definitely help, but ultimately you are likely to still get fatigue from time to time, sadly. And for me, I think I would just say that accept it, have a rest, accept that you can't do X, Y, Z at that time, and make sure you just look after your body, because then you're going to come back more, hopefully more productive. And yeah, I guess I would make an adjustment. Like, maybe if I was going to go into work that day, I wouldn't. I would work from home. If I had like two social occasions, maybe I might fill up to attending one. Maybe I might have to drop the other.
Thank you for joining the Sunflower Conversations podcast. Remember to hit subscribe.
You work full time, Lisa?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So do you have a combination of working from home and working in the office to accommodate for the low spoons and the pace?
Yeah, well, to be honest, we've got a flexible working policy anyway, so that's across the board, so we're really lucky. And yeah, I balance it out. I mean, I try and do it based on my work priorities, but if it did come up that I didn't feel well enough that day to go in, then it would be fine. I would just switch my days around.
And I think, as you said, you've got to put your health first, because otherwise you are going to be on your back and on your knees, and then you're not going to be any good to anybody, including yourself. So you have to put your health first, don't you? And then how do you emotionally feel when you've been invited to two events and you know that you just don't have the fuel to do both of them? How does that make you feel when you've got to decline events?
Yeah, it's tough. I think that has been one of the hard things, actually, because my natural instinct is to do everything or try and do everything. And I do find it quite emotional. Or if, you know, I have to weigh up, if I go to that dinner, I'm either going to have to pay lots of money to get there and back, or I'm going to have to do a really long walk, which means my symptoms are going to come on. So even things that seem like they shouldn't be a big deal, because they're just hanging out with friends around their house or something, for me now, it's much more complicated than that. And I do, yeah, I struggle a lot with that, to be honest. But there were a lot of changes that happened in the world since my diagnosis. And in some ways, I guess it sort of eased me in, because everybody had to change and everybody had to go out less. So I think it's actually only now becoming harder.
Lisa, can I ask a question also about your family and people are around you, you know, in terms of how has it impacted them? So if you've got loved ones or people that are around you, obviously they need, you know, they're going to need to change as well. And it's also how it impacts loved ones around you. And that interests me. You know, you obviously need help now. You need support perhaps in certain ways that you perhaps didn't have before. Has that changed greatly?
Not on a day-to-day basis, I would say, with my loved ones. But it definitely during when I had my relapses, for sure, 100%. My family were back and forth. They were absolutely incredible, checking in on me. Like, as I said, I mean, I live alone. So if I couldn't open a jar, then that's like a real issue. But I've got amazing friends who live nearby, and they've they've also just been incredible. I mean, and ones that live further afield. I stayed with some friends, you know, people have cut my food for me. They've been there for me. They've put up with me just sleeping all day and being tired by going for a shower and then having to go back to bed, you know, all those things. And I feel so lucky. And my advice to anyone is that if you do have support offered to you, then honestly, just take it. It's so hard. You want to say no, you want to keep doing everything yourself. But the reality is you can't. And actually the only way you're going to get out of that situation is to kind of do your best to rest and recover.
Lisa, is the long-term, have you had any kind of long-term diagnosis with this? Is there something that, you know, how do you see this progressing through your life, your condition?
For me, I try not to think about it too much, to be honest. I always try and focus on the moment because that's what I know and that's what I can deal with. And I think that's true of everyone in life. So I think you can really scare yourself if you start thinking too far ahead to where things may go. I think you have to be mindful of them and you have to look after your health in the best way that you can, like eat well, exercise, do all the things that are recommended. But for me, it's all about being in the moment and one step at a time, like quite literally at some points. But
I think that's a very healthy way of looking at life, actually. So I take my hat off to you for that. I think that's great. I think a lot more people could do with a bit of that. So, yeah, that's really good. My mum, just by coincidentally, just jumping out completely out of this conversation, both my parents worked for the Multiple Sclerosis Society years ago. Yeah, so my parents used to take us all around. We used to visit lots of people that were very much kind of dependent on help and support. So, you know, it's something actually I feel like a little bit like I'm connected to in a funny sort of way. They had a static home by the coast, and it was for anybody who had MS. And we used to go up there all the time. And my dad used to check it and make sure that it was running properly and all the rest of it. So. It's something that is we used to have a lot of people around and that had MS and certain people were I remember mums were literally dependent on their children looking after them, for example. So I know that there are very severe cases and also some not so severe cases. And is there medicine and treatments, Lisa?
Yeah, so people might have, there are so many different treatments. I couldn't possibly even know them all, but basically, some people manage from diet. If I guess their symptoms aren't severe or for other reasons, they may choose to go that route. Then there are a range of disease modifying treatments. So you can't cure MS, but you can try and manage it. It's quite overwhelming when you first get diagnosed because you have to make a choice, and obviously you want to make it as soon as possible, yet there are so many. It's like with anything, when you pick a medication, all the risks are presented to you and you're already coming to terms with what's happening with you, and you're also trying to rest and recover, so there's so much going on at that point in time. But there are great resources available from both the MS Society and the MS Trust. They're amazing. And I was eligible for a treatment called Ocrevus because my MS was considered highly active because I had two relapses within that first year. So first was the one that caused me to have the issues with walking, and then the one that caused me to have the issues with the hand. So I was quite, I always call it like a kind of weird kind of luck that although, like for me, because that medication has worked so well for me. So although it was quite a bad time, it meant that I was eligible for this treatment, which I think I'm very lucky to be on.
Yes, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So I have 6 monthly infusions and yeah, it's just worked really well for me. Touch wood, there's been no visible progress in my MRIs since I've been on it.
That's good.
So that's really amazing.
That is good news.
And Lisa, can I just quickly ask then? So you talk about treatment. I'm curious to know, do you, and obviously you don't have to disclose this, but because Or do you have medication? Do you have daily medication? Is there lots of medication? Is it something that you become, you know, you have to, do you get fed by the NHS now, like weekly pills that you have to take and so on and so forth? Is that something, as well as the treatment?
Yeah, not for me. I can't obviously speak for anyone else's unique situation, but no, not for me. I do think it's pretty standard that people with MS have to take high levels of vitamin D, or we're recommended to. So I do take vitamin D every day, but that's it really. Because yeah, the 6 monthly infusions manage my day to day.
That's good. Great. How long does the, did you say, sorry, like when you have the infusion, is that like a half a day at the hospital or how does that work?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, go in the morning, normally out early afternoon.
And do you feel instantly like, oh, that's giving me a bit of a boost?
No, the opposite. It's more like it makes me tired because I think it, the way that it works is that, this could be slightly wrong, so do not quote me on this. But I think it aims at the CD20 markers and attacks those in your blood because they think that they are the, that's what your immune system is trying to attack, mistakenly. So therefore, I feel quite tired after my meds, and that normally lasts for me for about a month afterwards.
Ooh, okay, so it's pretty intense.
But for some people, they then go back to work straight away. So for me, it doesn't really work. So I tend to take a few days rest.
Yeah.
And then I'll just try and take it easy for that first month.
Yeah.
But also it can vary from one lot of meds to the next.
Yeah.
Like, there's no like set rule. I guess maybe there's external factors that make a difference too, and other things that are going on. I find winter harder for some reason. But other people find summer harder, so.
Oh, right, okay, because I know when we spoke to somebody who has lupus, and traditionally for people who have lupus, the sun is actually not helpful at all, but it's interesting here where you could say for some it is and some it isn't. It's,
yeah, it can be completely different person to person.
We touched on earlier about, you know, being comic relief and working full-time. Are there any other adjustments that you have? You've got the flexible working, but everybody has that, but you would, if you didn't have it, it's something you would definitely request.
Yeah, for sure. And it was also recommended to me when I had an occupational health assessment to work from home 1 or 2 days a week. So yeah, I do. I have made an adjustment in more recent months where I compress my hours. So I try and take off Wednesday mornings to rest because I just find that means that by the weekend, like I'm not quite as exhausted because sometimes on a weekend I might need one rest day, for example. So Comic Relief also gives me leave for my medication days and any appointments I need to go to. They're very relaxed about. But aside from that, there's nothing specifically, but most importantly, like my boss is just so supportive. He trusts me, which is really important. So if provided, you know, it doesn't interfere with any specific work commitments, I can flex around. So if I'm feeling fatigued, I can have a nap and come back to work later, like, and just, you know, work a bit later into the day. Or, you know, as we said before, if it's an office day, like maybe I wouldn't necessarily go in, or for example, I might avoid rush hour. So all those kind of adjustments, however small they may sound, can make such a huge difference. And yeah, I'm so super grateful to Comic Relief for always supporting me. Since my diagnosis, I felt very supported.
When you were diagnosed, were you kind of told about how to then move forwards and treat it? Were you kind of sat down? Was there any kind of literature or anything given to you that kind of said, right, you have this condition and you now need to be mindful of this? You know, or was it something you've had to piece together and learn? Because you strike me as someone that's also kind of taken it upon yourself to kind of explore and work out and learn yourself. And I think you need to do that. I think, and also, we also pick up a lot of that, I think Chantel will agree, where people tend to sort of not self-diagnose, but they kind of to learn about their conditions a lot themselves and work it out, rather than have somebody say to them, right, you've been diagnosed with this, and actually these are all of the points that you may have to be considering moving forwards. This is going to impact you in your daily life.
Yeah, it's actually quite hard to have. I mean, you have a MS consultant, which is amazing. But one of the hardest, but that's after diagnosis. And I think one of the hardest things was during diagnosis. It's almost like you just need someone to say to you, we think it might be this. And that means that you should probably just rest for a while. Like, I think that permission to rest piece is really important, because I didn't give it to myself, and other people might have been saying it to me, but I wasn't going to listen to them because I hadn't been told it. Like, so I was like, no, I'm just pushing on. There might not even be anything wrong with me. They just think this might be it. You know, I mean, even though it was obvious there was something wrong with me, your mind does
100% agree
everywhere, right?
100% agree with that. I'm like that. It's like, oh, that's something else. It's just a, you know, I'm being over the top, or I'm, you know, I don't know, whatever. It's like you kind of self diagnosing, aren't you, and kind of saying that's because of this, and it might not be that, but actually there's something seriously going on. And
somebody was telling me that our brains are sort of almost programmed to fight against us.
Yeah,
I don't know where I heard that, but what you two are saying when with your lived experience is sounds definitely true.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I feel like with MS I'm really lucky, because although it's really sad, there's a massive support network out there, because so many people do have the condition. So
it's 190 people per 100,000 in the UK that have MS is the stat that I saw. I don't know if that's something you're familiar with.
I mean, I know it's a lot. I don't know the exact stats. So it's just incredible, isn't it? So I think one of the things that really made me think when I was going through diagnosis, because you have so many rule out tests, I literally was looking up every single thing. I was doing all the things you're not meant to do, and I wouldn't advise anyone else to do. Yeah. But I was looking up everything it could be.
Yes.
Seeing the different like support out there, like looking at what, you know, all that kind of thing. And I did feel very, very lucky in that weird, bittersweet way that there is a big support network out there. There's lots of information. I went to like some focus groups for the newly diagnosed. I went to some information days. I happened to have two friends that actually have MS. So I met with them, and that's invaluable, like absolutely invaluable. Just being able to have those kind of like, just really relaxed conversations. Yes. And say something to someone and they feel it, they know it, they're just like, yep, that's it.
Totally. So connecting with other people having a similar experience has been a very important part of the process for you.
Yeah, definitely. And then I did join some Facebook groups. There's a lot of support out there too. They're run by people with MS, so that's really super kind of them to do that, because it takes a lot of work. And I've dipped in and out of those because it was particularly helpful going through diagnosis. But I will say, like, I kind of have to step in and out of support too, because it can become so intense.
You're right, yeah, a bit all encompassing.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just sort of that knowing when I need that support and to step into it, and knowing also when actually that I can just get on with things at the moment.
Yeah, and not to feel guilty about that. That's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Why are there three times as many women as men with MS? That's interesting, isn't it? Again,
yeah, I don't know if that's really known. They may have some idea around it, but I don't know the answer to that. There's also some links to climate. I think you're more likely, I think this is right, that you're more likely to have it if you're in colder climes.
Wow.
But yeah, they're all like just, there's also a link with anxiety, but that's a bit chicken and egg, as in which came first.
Yeah, that's so interesting what you say about the colder climates, because it's autoimmune, but it's kind of neurological as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, so I was listening to something recently about you know how everyone's getting into ice baths, and Wim Hof has kind of really led the way on that. And now if you look at Instagram, every celebrity's got an ice bath in their garden and they're videoing themselves getting into it. But there are supposed to be like some major health benefits, but our brain tells us traditionally, or I guess when it's fighting against us, that cold is the enemy. And so we are not embracing that and actually using it to free ourselves and release ourselves. And actually, once you start doing that, which is why it's been so sort of revolutionary, although it's such a, it's not anything, you know, cold is cold.
Yeah, it's horrible.
People, people go and they do climb up mountains, you know, in just their shorts with Wim Hof, and then jump into a frozen lake at the end, and they feel exhilarated and they feel amazing. So that's quite interesting about that. I wonder what research has been done. But anyway, we can't talk to you all day. although we would like to.
Yeah, it's lovely,
what do you think about the Hidden Disability Sunflower?
Oh, I think it's amazing. So I had seen it around. I'd seen people wearing them, but I didn't know too much about it. But our wonderful head of EDI came on board and she brought it to my attention. And I hadn't really thought of it as a workplace tool, or I kind of, I knew that it was helpful in kind of if you were at the airport. So I kind of saw it more in those kind of situations. So we had some discussion around it. We did some more research, and then, yeah, we just saw what a brilliant thing it is. And we decided to recommend that Comic Relief implemented the scheme. So, yeah, we're really, really happy that we did that.
And how's it gone? Have you had, like, any feedback from colleagues?
Yeah, it's just been so positive. So we tied in the launch of the scheme with the launch of our We Can employee network group. We also shared the launch of our partnership with Business Disability Forum, as you know, because you were there. Thank you very much. And we received such brilliant feedback from colleagues. Honestly, it was just overwhelmingly positive. And we actually ran out of lanyards after the launch and had to order more, and I'd actually been concerned people wouldn't actually take them and wear them, so that just felt like such a great thing that people felt comfortable. And the launch prompted some really open conversations, people saying like what a big step forward it was, how they now felt that actually they wanted to talk about their conditions or their situations, and they hadn't really before ever in a workplace. So that was also absolutely brilliant. And others just said how grateful they were to understand more about it in general. Like that if they're out in public and they see someone wearing a sunflower lanyard, they now know what it means and they can help them or they can give them the understanding they need or the space. So yeah, just, all in all, just it's created so much positivity, and I'm so happy that we have launched that scheme.
We're delighted to hear that.
Love that.
Really
love that, Liz. That was very well spoken.
So we normally end on a question of, you know, do you your advice, but you have peppered a lot of advice throughout the conversation. So I don't know if you have anything further, or if you wanted to reiterate any of the advice that you've given or the charities that you approach. But the question is, do you have any advice for someone who has recently had their diagnosis and feels like the rug has been pulled from under them?
Yeah, it's really the same as before that I said that I give myself the same advice. So stay in the moment, slow down. Take one step at a time, because it's totally overwhelming. You do have decisions to make, and lots of them, and some of it's quite complex. So I think just one step at a time, be kind to yourself, rest is my big one.
Yeah.
Give yourself that permission. And yeah, try not to go racing ahead to what might happen, because it might not. So you just need to deal with what is happening in the moment. And yeah, embrace all the resources and the support groups that are available to you, and, you know, the offers from friends, family, colleagues, because people are really, really kind and they do genuinely want to help. And it makes such a massive difference. And I feel even emotional thinking about how much people have helped me. So,
yeah, you've got some very special people there in your life, Lisa. So,
yeah, for sure.
It's good to you know, gratitude and to be aware of the things that we should be grateful for is important. And if it brings a tear to your eye, then so be it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Paul, I just wondered if you just wanted to just finish off with the statistics. You had a little Google whilst we've been chatting. I just wondered if you wanted to just kind of...
Yeah, if you want me to...
Statistics that you found. Yeah, the one that I said, so was that, the one I found was 190 people per 100,000. So I don't know whether your one is the same thing, but said in another way.
I think there is slightly more.
Yeah,
so I'll just quickly read it out. Yeah. It says it's estimated that there are more than 130,000 people in the UK diagnosed with MS. That's one in 500, with about 130 people being diagnosed every week on average, which is
a lot.
Huge.
It's a lot. It's commonly diagnosed in people between the ages of 20 and 30, which is also quite young. And there are roughly three times as many women with MS as there are men. And Lisa, it's been lovely. It's lovely to talk to you and meet you. And thanks for sharing you. And you've been brilliant and very articulate. And it's been really, really enjoyable.
We will put the details of the chat, the couple of charities, if you send me the links, we'll put those in the show notes so that people can access the support that you've been talking about. So thank you very much for your time, Lisa.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
If you have enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, like and share to help raise awareness of non-visible disabilities and the Hidden Disability Sunflower. If you are interested in any of the advice discussed in this podcast, please follow up with your GP or healthcare practitioner.
If you'd like to share your sunflower story or conversation, please email conversations@hiddendisabilitiesstore.com. Find out more about us or listen to this recording again by checking out our insights page at hiddendisabilitiesstore.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn. Please help, have patience, and show kindness to others, and join us again soon. Making the invisible visible with the Hidden Disability Sunflower.